dipole when it's transmitting. It has an effective capture area when it's receiving of a 5.7 foot diameter circle, even though the elements are only roughly 1 foot long. If your eyes operated at 432 and you look down the boom of that antenna from a good distance away, you would see a black hole in space 5.7 feet in diameter. When it's receiving, almost all of the radio signal that hits that 5.7 foot diameter black circle in space, almost all of that energy gets focused down to the driven element. Almost all of that energy gets absorbed by that driven element, goes down the transmission line, and pegs your signal strength meter. It's not magic. It's just a well-tuned Yagi. The effective capture area is a hell of a lot bigger than what you see. In other words, if it was a 100% efficient 5.7 foot diameter parabolic dish antenna, it would have the exact same physical area with a huge amount of wind load and weight of materials. That skeleton structure of that Yagi has that area when it's receiving. It's hard to believe when it's transmitting it's got the exact same area. If you had a 100% efficient 5.7 foot diameter parabolic dish antenna at 432 and you transmit it, you'd have the exact same antenna pattern, the exact same gain. So this reciprocity principle of the science of antenna is a very powerful principle. In many cases, it defies the living daylights out of common sense. Let me drop. But once you accept the principle of reciprocity, when you're trying to mentally figure out what's going on with an antenna transmission system, and in the transmitting mode, it may be very difficult for you to picture what's going on, but in the receiver mode, it is easy for you to figure out what's going on. If I'm stacking two of those Yagis vertically stacked, and I want the effective areas to not touch each other, I'm probably going to use a 5.7 foot spacing between the two antennas. Now those two capture area circles are going to just be kissing each other, if you know what I mean. You move the two Yagis closer together where the areas overlap, and you start losing gain. You start getting some cross-coupling. And so there's some pluses and minuses of moving a little bit closer, and there's trade-offs, if you know what I mean. So whenever you've got a transmission system that you had trouble picturing it in the transmission mode, you can listen to it, you can picture it in the receiver mode, and you're talking about the exact same thing. Where life gets complicated, let me drop. I know for a fact that if you've got a reasonably efficient, well-designed antenna tuner, let's assume I had a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna on a very low-loss transmission line, and the antenna tuner is in the shack. And so, in that environment, I don't know the exact numbers, but you may have a 100-watt transmitter, and on the input end of that antenna tuner, it sees 50 ohms. So the transmitter is perfectly happy, no reflection going on there. On the output of the antenna tuner, because there's lots of reflection going on, in other words, of the power that hits the antenna, because it's got a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, a big fraction of it is reflected. It comes back down the transmission line. And when that antenna tuner is properly tuned, let me drop, the antenna tuner takes all of that power coming back down, re-reflects it forward in phase with the signal coming out of the transmitter right now. So you got a fair amount of power bouncing back and forth. You might see 150 watts going forward. You might see 50 watts coming back. If you use your bird wattmeter after the antenna tuner, you'll say to yourself, what in the world's going on? I know my transmitter only puts out 100 watts. I see 150 watts forward and 50 watts coming back. The antenna is radiating the 100 watts. It's reflecting 50 of it on each pass, if you know what I mean. So we're not defying physics here. But once you understand reciprocity and conservation of energy, and an antenna tuner that's well-designed, that runs cold, doesn't develop any heat, because it's well-designed with good-sized components, it's well-shielded, of all the energy that's reflected back from the antenna tuner can only do three things with it. Pass some of it onto the transmitter, it's not doing that. Radiate some of it in space, it's well-shielded, it's not doing that. Waste it as heat, but it's running ice cold, it's not doing that. So the only thing left by conservation of energy is re-reflecting the power forward. You say those words on the 20-meter band any day of the week, and a whole bunch of people will jump down your throat saying you're crazy. There's a lot of people out there have heard the story over and over. Let me drop the They believe an antenna tuner is a waster of power. They believe it takes all the reflected power and simply throws it away. There are other people who refuse to put a bird watt meter after the antenna tuner into an antenna system that's got a high visor because there's a ridiculous number of people who believe a bird watt meter only works correctly in a 50 ohm system. And the system with the high visor ain't 50 ohms anymore. Well, 99% of all the antennas that you tune are never perfectly 50 ohms. Does that mean you can never use a bird watt meter? Of course not. You could even use a bird watt meter, which is designed 50 ohms, and if the cable coming out of your antenna tuner going up to the antenna is a 70 ohm piece of hardline, can you use the bird watt meter there? Absolutely. You've got to do a little bit more careful in the way you interpret the results, but you're not violating physics. You're doing something that's perfectly traceable to the Bureau. So a bird watt meter can be put into any coaxial system if you know what you're doing, and the results you get have exact meaning, again, if you know what you're doing. So the law of reciprocity is going to be the major answer to your question, John. Whatever you get on transmit, you get the exact same effect on receive, with one other characteristic. Let me drop this. Our modern-day no-tune transmitters are very persnickety. They want to see a 1.7 standing wave ratio maximum, otherwise they start going into the self-protect mode to protect the final stage. So you need an antenna tuner that's going to bring your visor down below 1.7, so to speak. Whereas, receivers are much more forgiving. I can take an HF receiver, connect it to an antenna with a 50-to-1 standing wave ratio. I can get full performance out of that receiver. I won't get quite as much S-meter deflection on the signal I'm listening to. Correspondingly, I won't get quite as much S-meter deflection on the noise that's on the band, the atmospheric noise, but the ratio between the two will stay the same. I can take a yucky old piece of clip lead, connect it to the center conductor of my receiver, and the clip lead is 5 feet long, and I can hear signals beautifully on 80 meters with it when the band is open. The signals will be a little bit weaker on both noise and signal, but the signal-to-noise ratio will be approximately the same. So receivers are very forgiving on HF frequencies because of all the noise that's on the band, so to speak. So you don't necessarily need a perfect antenna tuner impedance match going back into the receiver on HF frequencies. Let me drop. But on the 432 band, where there is very little noise, if you now have a high visor into the receiver, some of that valuable signal on 432 doesn't get to the receiver. There's no noise for it to beat against, therefore you're losing signal and you're losing threshold on 432. So that receiver forgivingness doesn't work on 432. Works beautiful on 40 meters, so to speak. KC2SHO. Maybe you've got some more questions on some of that crazy information. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Yeah, real good. Very good explanation. And I think maybe there's just one scenario. Hopefully I can put it in words that do the scenario justice, or hopefully I have it well thought out in my head. When I adjust my tuner to match the impedance on the antenna, as you've described many times, the impedance mismatch at the antenna sends the energy back down the line as the reflected wave hits the tuner. The tuner then sends it back. You know, this is going on over and over. What about energy that's coming in on the antenna? That antenna is picking up that energy. What happens when it reaches that impedance mismatch? Is it then reflected back out of the antenna and not recoverable? I guess this is where I'm trying to figure out what's going on there. Or maybe I'm not looking at it as a whole system, because the resonance comes from something further down the line. Maybe that's the right way to look at it. K2RIW, KC2SHO, does the question make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, John. That's a darn good question. It's a question many people probably have had and weren't even sure how to ask it. Assume now I've got a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna. And that means that, rough guess, of all the power I put into it when I'm transmitting, almost half of that power gets reflected. That's not the exact number, but it's forth on the transmission line, and it all gets radiated. Yes, your transmission line will have some extra loss because all the energy is bouncing back and forth some number of times before it finally gets radiated. But if the transmission line is low enough in loss, that's not much of a problem. So the signal all gets radiated. When you're receiving, that 10 to 1 standing wave ratio was an impedance mismatch to your 50 ohm transmission line. So of all the effective capture area the antenna could have had, because of mismatch, it now has a smaller capture area. So that signal you're trying to launch from free space, stand by a second. That signal you're trying to launch from free space into your antenna, all of that signal will go into the antenna. In my example of my Yagi with a 5.7 foot diameter circle, only if the Yagi is well impedance matched. If the back end of the Yagi touching the transmission line has a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio, you'll get a pretty good VSWR in space of that signal that would have gone into the antenna. It reflects right there. It doesn't go through the antenna and go into the transmission line, not all of it, because there is a VSWR right there, and that signal gets reflected back into space before it gets into the antenna at all. Okay, by way of your low loss line and your antenna tuner in the shack, you've now matched that whole system. It is not only resonant at the frequency you're operating at, but the whole thing is now impedance matched. And one of the fancy rules of the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, one of their main rules of measuring any parameter of an antenna, gain, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, all the parameters you measure the antenna beam with and so on, only makes sense if you impedance match the antenna first. All the parameters you measure in an antenna only have reality if you impedance match the antenna, or if you know the amount of impedance mismatch and you mathematically compensate for it. Let me drop. Bottom line of all this is, because of conservation of energy, law of reciprocity, all the fancy work your antenna tuner does for you and the benefit it gives you on transmission, you get the exact same benefit on reception. You've now impedance matched that antenna to that transmission line. So let me put it another way. Assume you got a low loss transmission line. Assuming going into the antenna, if I made measurements with a good vector network analyzer right at the antenna, I might see 150 ohms of inductive reactance and 50 ohms of resistance. That would be a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio right at the antenna. And that's a pretty big impedance mismatch when I'm transmitting. The antenna tuner cancels that all out. If I now adjust my antenna tuner just right, and I now know that I transmit all my power with that low loss transmission line with that antenna, and I now do a fancy experiment. While that antenna tuner is tuned that way, I disconnect the antenna at the top of the transmission line. And with fancy instrumentation, I look into that transmission line. What will I see? I will see a 50 ohm resistance in series with 150 ohms of capacitor reactance. So let me repeat that. The antenna itself, this 10 to 1 VSWR antenna, has an inductive reactance of 150 ohms. When you adjust an antenna tuner just right, looking into that transmission line right at the antenna port, you see 150 ohms of capacitive reactance. The capacitive reactance that the antenna tuner plus transmission line presents to the antenna, plus the 150 ohms of inductive reactance in the antenna, they cancel each other. I've now got what results in a 50 ohm antenna looking into a 50 ohm system, so to speak. So the tuning you do at the antenna tuner corrects the impedance mismatch at the other end of the transmission line up.
Repeater, timeout.
Magic. And so now you've done electric. electronically you've done the equivalent of retuning the antenna to make it a perfect impedance match. So the total radiating system, antenna, feed line, antenna tuner, balun, whatever, if all of that hits resonance at your favorite frequency, and if all of that is properly impedance matched at your favorite frequency, as long as your transmission line is low enough in loss, as long as your antenna tuner is low enough in insertion loss, because it's made with big components, that whole system can have 100% efficiency on transmission and reception, because you've done all of that matching with that antenna tuner. An antenna tuner is a lot more valuable than first meets the eye. KC2SHO, K2LIW, go ahead, John.
Great explanation, Dick. Thank you very much. That clarifies exactly the question I had in my head. I wasn't so sure that, you know, what was happening on receive was quite that way. You've explained it in an excellent way. Thank you. Yeah, that's all I have. And now I feel more confident that, even more confident that the tuner's not not causing me any consternation. Very good. Thanks again for the option to pose these questions to you this evening. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, now that you've got that information, John, you can go one step further with it. First of all, the input impedance of most receivers is not exactly 50 ohms. But if you put a 50 ohm 10 dB pad there, you can force it to be a darn good 50 ohm input impedance. Once you've got that pad on the receiver, and you're listening to a steady state signal, it's not having any QSB, in theory you can take your manual antenna tuner, rotate its dials until you get the greatest S meter reading. You've now forced an antenna tuner to do a perfect impedance match between that crazy antenna and that length of transmission line, giving you maximum power into the receiver. And when you do that, you go back to the transmit mode, and you find out your antenna tuner was now perfectly tuned. You can tune it in the receive mode, as long as you can guarantee your receiver really is a 50 ohm load by way of that pad, just for that experiment. It works both ways. It aids both transmission and reception. The antenna tuner is not smart enough to know that the signal is flowing from left to right or right to left. It's doing the same impedance match in either case. It doesn't know the difference in signals, if you know what I mean. Let me drop
ETZ with a comment.
Go right ahead, Hal. I bet you've used a lot of antenna tuners. And if you use the good ones, they run ice cold. Go ahead, Hal.
They do. I just wanted to say another way of tuning is using a noise bridge. And they work great. You can get your whole thing tuned up very easily. You tune the receiver to the frequency, you have your noise bridge, you null out on the noise, and you're in like Flynn.
Yeah, quite a few of these noise bridges really are a Wheatstone bridge. And it's got four components in a diamond pattern. And from the 12 o'clock position to the 6 o'clock position is where you put your transmitter. From the 3 o'clock position to the 9 o'clock position is where you put your sensor. And if those four components in that diamond shape are all exactly 50 ohms, you get a null. So your noise source can be on the 6 o'clock to 12 o'clock position. Your receiver is on the 3 o'clock to 9 o'clock position. And when you force the impedance of your antenna to be exactly 50 ohms, you get a null of that noise. And therefore, it's another way of tuning. See, you can tune for maximum signal. You're tuning, in this case, with the noise bridge from minimum resertion, minimum reflected signal from your system. See, what the transmitter looks into the antenna tuner, let me drop. And when the antenna tuner is set just right, the transmitter looking into it sees a perfect 50 ohm load with no reflection. Your noise bridge allows you to find that fancy position where no signal is reflected. So no signal reflected is a fancy way of saying I've got a perfect 50 ohm match. So, anyone have any further questions on this subject before we go on to the mailbag? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
I have one more comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
Bridge is very sharp, where if you tune for maximum noise on the receiver, You're not as sharp, but when you choose for a double on noise, you got right on the money. Go ahead, Dick.
Which is almost the exact equivalent when you're using a slotted line in trying to make measurements. The nulls on the slotted line are very sharp, the peaks are very broad. Therefore, you can get a very exact readings when you do all your measurements on a slotted line looking for nulls. Now, slotted line is very unpopular these days because the vector network analyzer does it a lot better and does all the math for you. But nulls are sharp, and that's what Hal was saying. Anybody with any further questions or comments on the current subject, give me a call letters right now. K2IW and the TechNet. Okay. We've settled that one for tonight. So, John, what kind of deep questions have you got in your mailbag this week? And sometimes John gets as many as 78 mails in his mailbag. Lots of people have got lots of questions out there. Go ahead, John, KC2WGB. And by the way, what do you see on Echo Link tonight? You got it, John, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Right now we've got 7 sitting on Echo Link. Chat room is empty, but Echo Link is almost average. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my first. Alrighty, got a young amateur that wants to know about switching networks. Okay, what he's looking to do is he wants to know how to calculate the maximum number of positions that would be acquired if you had 4 or 5 switches. Each one has 2 positions. What he's basically asking is the permutations available with switching, and what is the easiest way to figure that out? So give him a rundown on, like, 4 individual 2-position switches. What are the permutations on that, Dick? Back to you, sir. KC2WGB.
Okay. It would be nice if his number of switches... Let me think about this. I think an odd number... Yeah, an odd number gives you a kind of a maximum. Okay. Your single-pole, double-throw, first switch takes the power out of the transmitter, puts it in port A or port B, depending on how you flip that switch.
Pole, single-throw, Dick.
Single-pole, single-throw?
Yes, either on or off.
Let me think about that.
Well, I have a shortcut, a quick one. When you're done, I'll show you how I used to do it years ago. It was a lot easier than trying to remember formulas.
I wasn't going to give you a formula. I was going to try to draw a mental diagram. Single pole, single throw, where it's either on or off. And if you're not using a T connector, where your signal goes into 2 separate switches simultaneously, which gives you a little bit of an impedance mismatch, not much of one, but if my output of my transmitter went into a T connector, and the 2 arms of the T connector each go to a single pole, single throw switch, I can now decide to go to output A, output B, or A and B simultaneously. And if you're operating at a low enough frequency, the fact that one of those arms is a very short length of cable into an open circuit gives you very little perturbation. You think you've got a 2-to-1 Viswire there, not necessarily if you use it right. So did you do it with a T connector, John? Because without using a T connector, only single pole, single throw doesn't give you an awful lot of selections. But maybe you found a crafty way. Over to you, John. K2LIW.
CP0Tom, what is he using this for, Dad? Maybe I can throw a little non-informative information in.
Yeah, John's got to give us a lot more info. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Basically, he's asking how many positions are available in a group of switches. If each switch has an on and an off, which is 2 positions, and you had 4 switches, how many combinations totally?
Yeah, with T connectors and fancy lengths of coax cable that are exactly a quarter wavelength long or a half wavelength long, you can do some funny things with tuning at a particular frequency. But with nothing but single pole, single throw switches, and 4 of them, how many antennas would you be able to select with that, Hal? K16PZ, K2IW?
WK6DPC. Well, I figure if you have single pole, double throw, you run all the switches, you pull off for each coaxial fitting to an antenna, so you can do four antennas.
Okay, you misheard the question. The question is single pole, single throw switches. Four of them. Now, how many antennas can you select on?
You're talking about like a light switch, single pole, single throw. So if you tie all the commons on the switches together, first, then you have an output for each one. You switch one off to switch the other one on. No, it's a big problem. VDH with a common?
Yeah, VDH will get to you in a minute. So you're putting all four switches together. These are coaxial switches. And you're feeding power into four switches simultaneously. What equipment did you use to do that with the HAL? Go ahead.
Well, basically what I did, I had two connectors, that's the coaxial switches, and you just switch them off, and you pick the one you want, and that's it. Bunch of T connectors and double male mates. You can do it, it's no big deal.
So you're using a whole bunch of T connectors to give you a 4-to-1 power divide, and that is going to each of the four switches simultaneously, all in parallel. Tell me what standing wave ratio that system's going to give you, Hal, K2IW.
He's only interested in how many positions are available. Nothing was mentioned about what he's switching.
We're trying to find out, is it going to work? Hal, what standing wave ratio are you going to get with that combination? Over to you, Hal.
Basically, Dick, if you have all the four switches close, and you isolate the couple switches but leave one on, you'll have a pretty good match. If you're putting switches and turning them on, it's not going to be too much.
Now, we only heard 50% of what you said, Hal. You're very noisy. Okay, the other person who wanted to give us a comment, please repeat your call letter, sir, your name, and then your comment. Go right ahead, K2RIW.
Yeah, fine business. WA2VDH, name is John. I think the question is just how many combinations can you get with four switches, which is 2 to the 4th, or 16. But if you want to look at it like your routing signal, you can take them as single pole, double throw. So one switch goes either A or B, and then on the output of those two, you would have another two switches, which could switch you off to four different places, and then another set of switches which give you 8, and then another which would give you 16. So I think it's going to be something like 2 to the 4th or 16. Go ahead.
The answer you gave, John, is pretty good if each switch is single pole, double throw. Each switch is single pole, single throw, on and off, and there's four of them. Now how many antennas can you select? Over to you, John.
Well, I think the question was just how many combinations. I don't think the question was asking how many antennas you can switch. I think he just wanted to know how many different combinations could these on-off switches give you, which would still be 2 to the 4th or 16. Go ahead.
Yeah, permutations is what we're looking for.
Okay. If I put the four switches all in series, and I'm deciding which ones are on and off, yes, I've got 16 combinations. Of those 16 combinations, about 12 of them are useless. No signal will flow through. So you can't use all of those combinations. Single pole, single throw switches are kind of hard to use. Yes, if you're using a T connector into two single pole, single throw switches on the two outputs of the T connectors, you've now, with the T connector and two switches, you've made a single pole, double throw out of two switches. And that's a useful arrangement. But many other arrangements, even though mathematically you've got a lot of combos, many of those combos are kind of useless with single pole, single throws, all in series. Back to you, John, KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, it is used in a lot of digital circuits and things like that, and I found the easiest way to do it is you count down, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, so it's 5. Times 4, times 3, times 1. So 4 switches, if I remember correctly, it'd be 24 combinations. Because if you look at it, you have 1 on, 3 off, 2 on, 2 off, then 3 on, 1 off, and then you reverse that structure going back, I believe it comes out to 24. Okay, there is a formula for it, but I just don't remember the formula either.
In the digital world, John, you're right. In the RF world, I strongly disagree. You can't create that many parallel paths in the RF world with coaxial switches and still have good impedance matching everywhere. So, the RF world and the digital world look fairly different in this environment, in my opinion. Back to you, John.
Okay, but he wasn't questioning that. He was just trying to find out, instead of going crazy, because when he runs into like six switches and trying to figure out the permutations, it was driving a little wacky. I know if he goes on the web, he can find that formula and it'll give him the exact numbers. But okay, I think we covered that enough, but that's an interesting question.
Yeah, go to the next question now, John.
Okay, give me a second. Okay, this gentleman is working, KC2WGB, this gentleman's working with a slotted line, and his detector, instead of it being instrumentation, is basically an antenna. And what he's doing is, and he wonders if he's doing it right, he has this antenna, which is a little short vertical antenna, and as he sweeps down the slotted line, he hits the peaks and valleys. When he gets to the peak, that's when he trims the antenna, maybe solders a top hat capacitor on it, and he is reading a air transmitted signal to a microvoltmeter and looking to peak it. Now he's wondering, by doing that, is he actually tuning the antenna and getting it exactly to the right length for that particular frequency and doing it that way?
Okay, quite a bit of ambiguity in the way you expressed the question, John. A slotted line normally has an unknown device on the coaxial output. A slotted line normally has a probe, which is tunable, which contains a rectifier, which comes out with a BNC connector, with a video signal. The way you worded the question, you made it sound like there is an unknown load of some kind on the coaxial output of the transmission line. By some magic, the person has mounted an antenna on the carriage of the slotted line, is what it sounded like. But there's a lot of problems with what you're describing, so you got to fill in a lot more blanks here, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Oh, you've got it right. He has the probe, only an antenna that's on the carriage that is going down with the exposed part of that antenna near the slotted line, the center tube, okay. And as he goes up and down, that antenna, when it's resonant, will transmit that particular signal that it's picking up. There's no diodes, nothing. It's just coupling the RF information that he's getting off of the peak area of that probe, of that line, that he's trying to transmit to his microvoltmeter. Is that a better description?
I'm getting a more complete picture of what the test is. The probe of a slotted line has a knob on it with a tuning structure inside. Depending on where you set that knob, the impedance presented to that BNC connector goes up and down in reactive, inductive, and whatever. So the setting of that knob is a variable. The fact that there's a rectifier and resonant circuit inside is a variable. The probe going down toward the slotted line center conductor is picking up various amounts of signal. And you didn't say what is terminating the transmission line. If the transmission line was terminated with a perfect 50 ohm load, then no matter where you adjusted the carriage, you get the exact same signal all the time. If the load on the transmission line was a short circuit, yes, you're going to have peaks and valleys. But each of those peaks and valleys, as you slide to the left and to the right of a valley, or to the left and the right of a peak, the probe is picking up a different impedance on the transmission line. So we got a number of simultaneous variables. The impedance picked up by the probe is changing as a function of position. The impedance presented to the antenna is changing as a function of the resonant circuit with that knob that you're adjusting. And on top of that, the carriage contains a rectifier trying to give you a video voltage, and you're feeding a video voltage with some RF feed-through into an antenna and trying to make a judgment. you're going to make things, as you change all the variables involved, things are going to go up and down. Are you getting a good impedance match to the antenna? I doubt it. If you're lucky, maybe, but you'd have to be awful lucky, and it's a lot more info you'd need, I think. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
Basically, he's using it as a directional coupler. That carriage means nothing. The only thing the carriage is doing is allowing him to transport the antenna up and down the length of the slotted line. The antenna that goes down, the base of that antenna is what is picking up the signal. There is no knobs, no nothing. It's just riding on that carriage. So now, if the antenna is resonant, he's figuring, if he has it exactly right, he should get the maximum energy on the microvoltmeter when he is properly tuned when he gets near that peak. That's basically what he's doing.
Okay. Your first statement, John, was that the slotted line is a directional coupler. Absolutely not. That probe on a directional, on a slotted line is a non-directional coupler because there's some signal flowing forward into the unknown load and some signal reflected from the unknown load, and those two signals are beating against each other into that probe. The probe is the world's best non-directional coupler. It's a bi-directional coupler. So as you move that probe to various, the carriage to various positions, you're getting more and less signal depending on how close you are to a null or a peak. And you only get nulls and peaks if you intentionally put a mismatch, like maybe an open circuit on the slotted line. Now, you want to believe that the probe is a 50 ohm source to the antenna. Very unlikely. Now, if the probe represented a 50 ohm source to the antenna, and now you're tuning the antenna for best performance, yes, you're adjusting your antenna for 50 ohms. I'd much rather see the guy take a piece of coaxial cable into the antenna, tune the antenna in various ways by tuning the antenna itself until his microvolt meter picks up maximum signal. That's now, assuming he's got a good 50 ohm signal generator at some reasonable setting of its output control into a 50 ohm cable into his antenna that's mounted on some kind of a fixture, and now he maximizes the performance of that antenna into a microvolt meter at some given distance, and he accounts for all the multipath signals in the room. As he walks around, he's going to be adding and subtracting multipath signals. That way he can tune an antenna. To use a slotted line carriage as a source of signal, which in general is far from 50 ohms, if you put a vector network analyzer into that probe of that carriage, of that slotted line, and you measured that impedance, I'm pretty sure you're going to be very unhappy, John. You're going to see a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio, and using that as a source to an antenna that you're tuning can allow you to tune an antenna that might not be a good tuning 99% of the time. KC2WGB, K2IW, are you starting to see what I think is a problem, John? Go ahead.
Oh yes, I see a lot of problems with the experiment, but he's having fun with this, and he's learning, and I think it's a very good thing to chase, and I think he can learn a lot by continuing the experiment and make his measurements, see what works best, and the reason I use slotted line is to get rid of everything else. There's no knobs, no diodes, and nothing. It's just an L-shaped piece of rod going down that's picking up the signal from the delay line center port. So, and you know, he's playing around with it, but it's a tough way to do it. But I don't think he has any other type of equipment to do the analysis. Yeah, vector network analyzer, he can do it in 2 seconds, but he's having fun. All right, but apparently he's basically wasting his time, because even if he does get it to work and he gets a nice healthy signal out of it, there's no way to prove that it would work again using it as an antenna alone. It may work with the slotted line, but standalone it may not work.
During this experiment, what do you believe is the termination on the slotted line?
An open circuit.
Okay, you may have said that and I missed it. So it's an open circuit. Therefore, the slotted line is by definition giving you an infinite standing wave ratio. Therefore, you have very deep nulls and some nice peaks. And so the peaks and depending on how close you get to a peak, it really is a kind of variable attenuator between your signal generator and that antenna, which then goes to your microvoltmeter. Now, the majority of carriages for a slotted line contain a probe where you can change the depth of the probe. They contain a tuning network with a black knob. Both inside of that tuning network is a rectifier that comes out with a BNC connector. That in turn goes to your Hewlett-Packard 415 standing wave ratio display device. That's what the usual carriage is. You make it sound, John, like you own some carriages that are nothing but a simple probe going into a BNC or type N connector, and the tuning network and the rectifier, all of that is missing. Do you own a carriage that is nothing but a probe and a coaxial connector? Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Yeah, from having so many of the slotted lines, I have a lot of carriages, and I eliminated a lot of the ancillary stuff on the carriage, except for the BNC port. I've removed the control diode, so all I have is an open hole now going down where I can stick different types of probes. Sometimes it's actually a probe from one of my meters, and I use it. That's what I use those carriages for.
Okay. You personally, John, KC2WGB, cannibalized a carriage of a Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line. You cannibalized that carriage, took a lot of the stuff out, and rewired it. Do you believe the guy you're talking to did that exact KC2WGB type of cannibalizing? Do you believe he did that, John? Go ahead.
No, he may have just mounted the probe adjacent to the carriage, using the carriage for support and transit, so that he would have reliable measurements for the linear motion. That's what he may have done. It doesn't look like the probe has been cannibalized. It's just adjacent to the probe.
Now, let me go back about three transmissions, John, and maybe there's something good to discuss here. You use the word directional coupler and slotted line. Is there some combination by which you believe you can convert a slotted line into a directional coupler and make the probe in there directional? Because under normal circumstances, it operates because it is absolutely non-directional. It is a bi-directional coupler, no directivity at all. So I'm not quite sure how you use the word directional coupler and slotted line together in the same sentence, so to speak. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Okay, well, first reference to slotted line and directional coupler was just to eliminate all of the other nonsense with the transport carriage, because a directional coupler just has that little piece of wire that comes down, it's L-bent and it's close-coupled and in proximity to the through port. All right, but yes, I have actually made slotted line, that is, not a slotted line into a directional coupler by a very simple method. I took the same method that's used in a directional coupler. I put a probe wire down for a length, I think it was like maybe a 2-inch L-bend on it, terminated that at 50 ohms, I think it had to be 58 ohms to make it work, and I was able to use it as a directional coupler for the slotted line itself.
Yeah, give me some words on that. The 58 ohm resistor was mounted where? Did the wire going down into the slots of the slotted line go down, bend into a U-shape, come back up, then it hit the 58 ohm resistor, and the far end of the 50 ohm resistor was then grounded to the carriage? Is that the picture you just described to us, John? Go ahead.
Yes, it wasn't a U-shape. It went straight down, and it was bent at 90 degrees like an L, and then from the end of the L, about maybe a quarter of an inch back, there was a 58 ohm resistor that went straight up to the carriage, the transport.
So, the leads on the 58 ohm resistor, plus the L bend of the probe coming out of the carriage, that made a side view U-shaped object, a very tall U-shaped object, and that in turn, yes, I do agree with you, that is a directional coupler. And what do you believe is the directivity you got out of that, John? Was it like 20 dB or so of directivity with a 50 ohm resistor? Go ahead. And what frequency were you doing this at?
I was doing this at 150 megahertz. I believe that was 18 dB. I didn't get 20 dig. I didn't get that high. It was, you know, pretty sloppy, but it did work, and it worked extremely well. Because what I did was I modeled it after a directional coupler. I said, well, if that works, yeah, I know it's in this exotic chamber and all that, but a simple one should work in a delay line. And when I built it, I was surprised. It took a couple of times, but I got it to work pretty reliably.
Yeah, that's very crafty. You're building a slotted line version of a Bird Model 43 watt meter. The slug that's inside the Bird watt meter, the removable slug, if you took it apart, contains that U-shaped thing that you just described with a resistor in series with it, just like you described. And I'm guessing you measured directivity by putting some signal down the slotted line into a 50 ohm load, measuring the signal strength into a spectrum analyzer picked up by your directional probe. Then you reverse the two input and output leads of the slotted line and measure the difference in dB. Is that the way you measure directivity without moving the carriage? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, I had to do it that way because I couldn't reliably get the carriage back in the exact same spot. Even though it's marked, it's not the same. You would be surprised moving that carriage a millimeter and a half, and that directional coupler worked differently. So that's exactly what it did. I just reversed the two end connectors.
If you had a good 50 ohm load on the slotted line, and a good signal generator with a 50 ohm source, with your directional probe, and your directional probe is now in the pickup direction, if you slid that carriage along the slotted line, did the signal strength you pick up change very much? Over to you, John, K2IW.
Wow, I'm trying to remember now. It's a while ago I did that. I noticed that the signal worked better on the end that was furthest away from the generator. If I had that, if I took the carriage, the transport carriage, and moved it toward the generator, it hardly worked at all.
Yeah, I see a complicating factor here. Your probe, your U-shaped probe with a 50 ohm, 58 ohm resistor in series, is attempting to be a high directivity coupler, similar to what you've got on a slug of a Bird Model 43A watt meter. However, when you take that probe assembly with its carriage and move it close to the far end or the near end of the slotted line, your probe is now starting to see capacitive coupling to the vertical wall that's at the end of the slotted line, the vertical wall that has the output connector attached to it. So as you move your probe closer or further away from that vertical wall, you're changing the tuning of the probe, and that's what I think you experienced. Had you been able to tune the probe when the carriage is in the middle of the slotted line and get high directivity by reversing the two ends of the slotted line, then for two-thirds of the motion up and down the slotted line, you would have kept the directivity. So I think your tuning procedure, I think the tuning procedure for your probe was being contaminated by that vertical wall at the far end and the near end of the slotted line. Beautiful experiment. And I think you went down that road, because I've been predicting for some time, an experiment that I've never done, that if you had a really good directional probe on the carriage of the slotted line, as you move the probe along the slotted line, you would see no change in signal, even if you had a highly mismatched load. That would prove that the signal flowing down the slotted line is constant going forward. The signal coming back is constant coming back. Only when the two beat against each other into a non-directional probe, now you see the peaks and valleys. So it's a beautiful concept of the fact that the signal going transmission line, and the signal going right to left on the transmission line. Let me drop. Those two signals are independent events that fall through each other with absolutely no interaction at all on the transmission line. It's a crazy concept, but it's true. Only when you're using a non-directional probe, which is picking up a sample of some of the forward-flowing signal, and the non-directional probe is also picking up a sample of some of the directional, the reverse-flowing signal, now the probe mixes the two together, and the first time they beat together in the probe, and now you see the peaks and valleys that we call standing wave ratio. So the probe makes the standing wave ratio. The slotted line itself does not. Ain't that crazy? Over here, John, K2IW.
KC2WGB. Yes, it is, because you envision those peaks and valleys riding on the center line of the slotted line. Not that it's being created in the probe, but you know, you brought up a very interesting point, and now I think I understand what was going on. Why was it different at the generator end than the extreme end? Well, here's what I think, and let's see what you, if you follow, or if you believe the same thing. The probe come down, let's say the generator is on my left, the slotted line is directly across my chest, and I have the probe in the carriage, it goes straight down, bends in an L toward the generator. Now, as I slide the transport toward the generator, the probe gets a lot closer to the end bell of the slotted line. Then when I go to the extreme end, it's still pointing away from the slotted line. It's not having as much capacitive coupling, I believe. What do you think?
Very good guess, John, but I think no. Depending on what you used as a load, had you been using the ordinary probe of a slotted line, you would have measured peaks and valleys when you slide that carriage across the slotted line. Those valleys occur in very specific positions. Depending on the nature of your load, the positions of those nulls move to different places. One of those nulls or one of those peaks might be very close to the end bell that's on the load side. It might be relatively far from the end bell on the input side. So therefore, when you're moving your directional coupler to get a particular response, and you want to find a peak or a valley, because the nulls are not symmetrical across the slotted line, depending on what you're using as a load, you're going to get a different performance when the carriage with your directional coupling probe is closer to the output bell or the input bell. So you didn't necessarily have symmetric distribution of the nulls. If you had a way of changing the load on the slotted line such that the nulls now fell in a symmetrical position along the line, that would have been one help. Let me drop. But now there's another funny thing happening. As you put your directional probe closer to the output bell, the output bell is far away from the 58 ohm resistor. As you put your directional probe carriage closer to the input bell, now the 58 ohm resistor is closer to the bell, and yes, capacitive coupling to the 58 ohm resistor versus capacitive coupling to the straight piece of wire of the L on the two, depending on where the carriage is, that's going to be a difference. If this is the best of all worlds, your probe wire would have gone down, made an L-shaped bend, it would have made a second L-shaped bend and came back up into the carriage, and if the 58 ohm resistor was now inside of the carriage, now to the external world, you have a thoroughly symmetric directional probe system. But because you've got that external 58 ohm resistor, which has a different capacitive coupling to one bell versus the other bell, depending on what the carriage is positioned, that's one of the variables you were playing with. The RF world is complicated, John. Mother Nature's got all kinds of traps set for us. There's only 50 ways of doing it slightly wrong. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I can see one way of improving that test if I ever get back to it. I could set the frequency so that I have a peak, say 2 centimeters from each end bell, whatever that frequency would be, and then try to make those measurements and make adjustments to that probe. That might help.
Yes, but you're still going to get a minor variation when the probe is closer to the input bell versus the output bell, vertical wall, because the 58 ohm resistor is going to have a slightly different coupling characteristic to one bell versus the straight piece of wire coupling to the other bell. There's going to be a slight difference, but you'll have a lot more symmetry as you adjust the frequency so that the metal's in the right place. I presume you were running the slotted line with an open circuit to make sure you had real, lots of good viswire during this test, John. Over to you, K2IW.
Yes, I did. I wanted to make sure I had enough energy coming off of that center line, and an open circuit was working much better than a short circuit for some reason. It seemed to be, I think it was at least a third higher in voltage on the indicators.
Okay. Do you have another mailbag you'd like to go through? If so, please do. KC2WGB, K2RIW, and TechNet.
Yes, I do. This young amateur, well, scientist, I'll say, is doing some marvelous things with gyroscopes. I don't know. He must have some money. He's got a what looks like a very expensive gyroscope. It's 10 inches thick. It's a huge thing. And he also has a 5-inch, and he has a few others. But what he's done is he spins up the 10-inch, and he gets it to sit on the table there and go through its rantics, and then he winds up the 5-inch and stands it on top of it, and he watches that dance. It's, he said, very symmetrical, and the tilting and leaning and how they interchange between one at a more severe angle than others back and forth. Now, if he tries it the other way around, the 5-inch on the bottom and the 10-inch on top, it doesn't maintain at all. It falls immediately. So he'd like to know if you've ever tried anything like that and anything else that you've discovered, possibly. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yes, I have done a series of gyroscope experiments, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Interesting experiment that he did. Let me think about this for a second. Yeah.
Study in double precession.
Oh, yeah. At least that's going on, among other things. Once you have selected the diameter of a gyroscope and the length of the shaft that goes down to the table, so to speak, you have now set the rate at which it precesses. It wiggles in a very characteristic manner that they call gyroscopic precession. The reason it precesses is because as it leans a little bit to one side, let's assume now that I've got it on the table and I start off with it leaning 5 degrees to the north. And let's assume that the gyroscope top view is spinning clockwise. Let me think about this for a minute. Yes. If the gyroscope is spinning clockwise top view and I lean it to the north, it will precess in such a way where it'll first wiggle toward the east, then toward the south, then toward the west, then back to the north. So I've spun the gyroscope clockwise. I'm looking at a top view. I've tilted it a little bit toward the north to begin the process, and it's going to precess also in a clockwise manner. With a little bit of a difficulty, I could explain why it does that. And if I started off with the experiment, let me think about this. I could start off with a tilt at 10 degrees instead of 5 degrees. It would still tilt, it would still precess clockwise. Yep, and would it precess faster?
Repeater, timeout.
I think it will precess a little bit faster. The rate of precession is a function of the disturbing force. When I've got it tilted 10 degrees instead of 5 degrees to the north, it has a greater force of upset, so to speak. Gravity is trying to, if there was no gyroscope there and I tilted it 5 degrees to the north and let go, it would simply fall to the north.